give to the number two, WBAI.org online. Okay? All right. It's almost 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large coming up. It's now 1 p.m.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. What do a Dutch Jewish fixer, a gender-fluid Manchu princess, and a lusty Nazi masseur have in common? At first glance, very little, but Ian Buruma has chosen to feature the three of them as the central characters in his latest book, The Collaborators, Three Stories of Deception and Survival in World War II. It's published by Penguin Press and brings Ian Buruma, professor at Bard College and a regular contributor to Harper's and The New Yorker, to our show now. Welcome.
Here. You can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you.
Good.
Although you do sound like you're in in a tunnel or something. But I can hear you fine.
Okay.
You open your book by saying that, I'm quoting, "On the face of it, the three main characters in your book have very little in common, aside from the fact that each committed wartime acts that led some to see them as national heroes, but others as awful villains."
Yes, I'm not sure they're national heroes. Some of them after the war were villains in the sense that all three certainly cooperated with very villainous politics and regimes. Mm-hmm.
Germans and Japanese forces during World War II.
Not just the Japanese forces. It was the Kawashima Yoshiko, the Manchu princess, who was partly grew up in Japan, daughter of an Japanese ultra-nationalist, cooperated with the Japanese secret police in the... She was pretty culpable, but... you never know what is true, and that is what all three have in common.
Well, you say that you were determined to treat these three people with fairness, even compassion. Why? Weren't all three con artists and collaborators who engaged in some pretty awful behavior?
It's much my intention to show any particular warmth, but I do believe when you write about people who do bad things, who make the wrong decisions, you have to try and understand them as human beings, and because all human beings are fallible. And
we're having real problems with disconnection.
You can't hear me?
No, but you keep on breaking up, actually.
No, that was probably because I was hesitating. And all human beings are tempted to do bad things, so when you write about those people, you have to do it with an understanding, not just to condemn them.
Did you learn about them first when you were studying and working in the Netherlands, Japan, Hong Kong, and London?
Yes, in these various places. It was the British historian Hugh Trevor Roper who actually put me onto Himmler's masseur, Felix Kirsten. Kawashima Yoshiko is a legendary figure in Japan, and I knew people who knew her. That was something that was in my head for a long time. And Weinreb, the Hasidic con man, young people don't really know about him anymore, but was a famous figure in the 70s when I was a student because he became a darling of the counter-establishment left.
Well, to describe him a little further, Felix Kirsten was a Finnish masseur to Heinrich Himmler and others in the Nazi elite. Yoshiko Kawashima was a Manchu princess who spied for the Japanese, and Friedrich Weinreb was a fixer whose fellow Jews paid him to secure reprieves from deportation to concentration camps. But, of course, he betrayed them to the German secret police.
Well, he pretended to be a fixer.
Yeah.
That they like to be in the vicinity of power and think of themselves as big shots. Weinreb was not a big shot at all, but he pretended that he was in close touch with powerful people and had these lists that people in exchange for pay. But it was all phony. It was all a game he was playing.
But you also write, I'm quoting, "We should reserve hasty moral judgment. None of the three was utterly depraved. They were all too human, especially in their frailties. But a lot of people suffered as a result of what they did."
That is absolutely true.
Well, I would assume that many people who do bad things are just all too human, especially in their frailties. Oops, we're losing you again.
Want to write about these people, you have to recognize that frailties are human. So it's not that I don't see the suffering that they caused. It's that in deciding to write about these characters, you want to make them interesting and you want to understand them and you want to understand the period. Simply voicing condemnation is not a very interesting literary enterprise.
Well, okay, let's look at them briefly. Kawashima Yoshiko was a cross-dressing daughter of a Manchu prince who'd been displaced during the 1911 revolution. Was cross-dressing more acceptable at the time than it might be in Florida today?
No, I don't think so. I think she was considered an eccentric at the time as well. She may not have been condemned in the same way that right-wing Republicans might do so. It wasn't really an issue at the time. Hmm.
She spied for the Japanese secret police in China, and they described her as a heroic combination of Mata Hari and Joan of Arc.
Yes, and she was very much conniving in her own legend management. What they liked about her was that they, in their propaganda, invasion of China and the war in Asia was supposed to be a liberation of Asia and kicking out the Western imperialists and so on, even though the Chinese were the victims of this and millions of Chinese consequence. But they liked the idea of a Chinese princess or a Manchu princess being on the Japanese side. So they built her up as this heroine in the Japanese media, full of derring do and private armies and so on, much of which was as fictional as Weinreb's lists.
Well, her story is rather sad. She'd been given as a young girl by her parents to a well-connected Japanese adoptive father who most likely raped and abused her. And you say that led Yoshiko to decide to bid farewell to womanhood. So that's why she cut her hair short and began wearing men's clothing and uniforms?
Well, that's one of the explanations. It's something that she said, that she didn't trust men, and men led freer and more better lives than women, and so she wanted to be a man. But she said other things too. Sometimes she dressed up as a woman. So it's ultimately, I think, a mystery like so much else in the lives of these characters, and there is not one easy explanation, I don't think.
At her 1945 trial in China, wasn't the list of allegations against her rather long?
Yeah. That was woven around her during the war as evidence. So they would take movies made about her and not in a fictional evidence against her. So it was a very peculiar trial. It was indeed, in many ways, a sad.
They said she had formed her own army to conquer Chinese territories in Manchuria. She'd plotted the invasion of China. She helped to start the Battle of Shanghai. She passed along Chinese military secrets. She spread Japanese propaganda. And she sought to revive the Qing dynasty. Wow.
Well, the last point, that was certainly one of the reasons that she became a collaborator in that Manchus who had, after all, it was the Manchus who ruled China during the Qing dynasty and were brought down in the revolution in 1911 when China became a republic. Manchu aristocrats there was a dream that somehow, together with the Japanese, or with Japanese help, they could revive the Qing dynasty. So that she was probably part of that romantic notion. Much of the other things that were held against her in her trial were patent nonsense, or at least there's a grain of truth in all those allegations, but only a grain.
She didn't help to start the Battle of Shanghai?
I don't think she had the authority to do any such thing. She may have done the Japanese bidding
to help things along.
I'm sorry?
You broke up again. She might have done the Japanese bidding to help things along.
To help things along and so on. She certainly played a role. But the idea that she instigated the battle or anything of the sort is, of course, nonsense.
Friedrich Weinrib was a Hasidic Jew, you said, in Holland. Why was he regarded by his supporters as the Dutch Dreyfus?
Well, what happened is that he probably betrayed fellow Jews during the war. But one always has to realize that as a Jew himself, he was always under great threat. He could death camps himself. Nonetheless, he did betray people. He was a fraudster. And after the war in 1945, he was tried a special court for defrauding fellow Jews, went to prison. Was supported by some people, including some people in the United States, was that this was an unfair trial. He was a scapegoat. He was, as he put it, the Dutch Dreyfus. Now, this disappeared for a long time, this defense. People hadn't heard of him for a long time until the 1960s, when for the first time, people began to pay attention to the Holocaust in general, but also in Holland. And a book came out called the Ondergang, the downfall, about the Holocaust in the Netherlands. Who wrote this book, wrote a chapter where he brought up the story of Weinrib and called him a scapegoat, and that he was made a scapegoat for the Dutch authorities, the bureaucrats, the policemen, and so on, who cooperated with the Germans during the war, or at least looked the other way. And so he became a kind of hero of the anti-establishment left, who saw him as a sort of passive resistor playing games with the establishment in the way that was then fashionable.
But didn't one Nazi officer later recall that Weinrib, quote, betrayed many families, he told us everything, and really did his best? Oops, we're losing you again.
Of course, one always has to be careful, of course, with the whatever former Nazis say. It's not entirely dependable evidence. When in the 1970s, and a debate between the right and the left over what Weinrib had rarely done or not done, there was a committee of serious historians who really went into his case, and they came up with a lot of evidence which showed that he was guilty.
Well, didn't he pretend to be a doctor and administer, you write, quote, thorough, often painful gynecological examinations involving a lot of probing and useless injections?
That was another one of his fantasies, yes. He pretended he'd even forged a letter which showed that he'd finished his medical studies in Vienna, all of which was nonsense. And he did, he was perverse in that he did pretend to be a doctor who had to subject women to medical examinations before they were supposedly put on trains to safety to Switzerland and Portugal and so on.
Sexual abuse, no?
Sexual abuse, absolutely.
Didn't he admit, in fact, that he was not an ordinary man intellectually or sexually?
Well, I think he did say that, but I think he meant it almost as a form of boasting. He was an immigrant, secular Jewish family, and I think his orthodoxy and later his life as a guru who claimed to wealthy and well-connected ladies the meaning of life by a Kabbalistic reading of the Bible, he thought that clever and superior to everybody else. He basically thought everybody was a fool. And so his games were a way for himself to prove his superiority. And I think he, when he said, "I'm not an ordinary man," I think he meant that as a boast.
My guest on today's Leonard Lopate at Large here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org, is Ian Buruma, whose latest book is The Collaborators, Three Stories of Deception and Survival in World War II. It is published by Penguin Press. The third person we are talking about is Felix Kirsten. How did he become Himmler's personal masseur?
Well, again, everything that he said about his life has to be taken with a grain of salt. So we never know quite what is true. But he was in Weimar, Berlin in the 1920s when there was a lot of wellness and mumbo-jumbo, guru-like mumbo-jumbo, Hinduism, Buddhism, yoga, and so on around. And he claimed, and the fact that he says he was Tibetan is already grounds for suspicion, because whenever people talk about Oriental mumbo jumbo, they quickly come up with Tibetans. Many massage, and he became the masseur to rich and well-connected people all over Europe, royalty, aristocrats, big industrialists, and so on. Many of whom later, in Germany at least.
Ooh, we're having real problems with this connection. Should we try to reconnect, Reggie?
I guess we could try.
Why don't we just take a minute's break and try to reconnect the phone? Because right now, it's hard to understand some of the things you're trying to say, and this is all really complex stuff. So. Let me remind my listeners that my guest is Ian Buruma, who is a regular contributor to Harper's and The New Yorker, and he's a professor at Bard College, and his book is The Collaborators, Three Stories of Deception and Survival in World War II, published by Penguin Press. Reggie, do you think we got a better connection this time?
Yet.
Okay, we're still trying. It's a complicated story because these people did bad things, but Mr. Buruma also is rather sympathetic to them in some ways, and that's what I want to get into in a little while. We're trying to reconnect, and... Oh, I have to just keep on babbling. Okay, well, while Reggie tries to make the connection, a reminder, of course, that we're in the midst of fundraising here at WBAI. And at this time, just for a few days, we're offering a series of collections that contains archive material on flash drives called The Best of BAI. There are three different flash drives. One is Best of BAI Shows and Favorite Hosts. Another is Best of BAI Classic Past Historical Truths. And the third is Best of BAI Current Events and Consequences. And they are yours. Well, one of them will be yours, the one that you choose, for a pledge of $99. If you go to... give to WBAI.org or give us a call at 212-209-2950. Remember that over the years, BAI Radio has won awards for news, arts, and music programs. So we're offering this audio collection that features the best of BAI. Are we okay, Reggie?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, we do try our best. Sometimes there are problems, as we are facing right now. But that is not unusual, as The governor of Florida just discovered when he tried to do something, announce his
okay,
that he was running for president. Yes, Rich.
Okay, let's try it again. And Ian needs to unmute. Ian, make sure you unmute so we can hear you.
Are you there, Ian?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, okay. What a better connection. Oh, boy.
Okay. All right. Now, I'm now using my iPhone instead of a computer, so maybe that's better.
This is perfect sound. So
okay.
I'm very pleased. We were talking about Felix Kersten.
Mm-hmm.
Of the three people you've profiled, he comes off best, but only because, as you write, he cannot be held responsible for mass murder.
But he can be held responsible for making the life of a mass murderer more comfortable.
Yeah, he treated him with stomach pains and other ailments and often gave him massages so Himmler could start his day refreshed. And Himmler called him his magic Buddha?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Himmler suffered from terrible stomach cramps, like apparently many people in despotic courts suffer from this in an atmosphere where you're always watchful that somebody might plunge a dagger in your back. So he had these terrible pains. Kersten was the only one who could relieve his pain once in a while, which gave him a certain amount of power over Himmler. And so he became his confidant. This, of course, was resented by other people in Himmler's entourage, all of whom were fighting to be to have influence, the astrologer, the doctors, other members of the SS and so on. So Kersten was in a very peculiar position.
Well, he always had something to eat when others were going hungry. He had grand real estate holdings, and he had help that was imported to one of his homes from the nearby Ravensbrück concentration camp. So how innocent could he have been under those circumstances?
Well, not particularly innocent at all. I mean, he was not, as you said, he was not a mass murderer, but he was certainly implicated. I think Kersten was one of those people. He always said he wasn't interested in politics, a communist. But he was somebody who always wanted to be near power. He wanted to be a fixer. Like the other two, he wanted to be somebody in the know, etc. And before the war, the people who his clients had been powerful people, not all of them Nazis. During the war, they happened to be Nazis because he was in Germany. And after the war, he tried to restore his reputation by going back to the rich and powerful and well-connected of Europe, and then had to. But doing that, having been Himmler's masseur, was not the best way to burnish his reputation. And so he then pretended, wrote a memoir and had other people make his case and so on, that actually he'd been a sort of resistance hero. Correct. And in exchange for relieving Himmler of his stomach pains, he persuaded Himmler not only to release people from concentration camps, but to stop Himmler from deporting the entire Dutch population to Poland in 1941 or 42, which is a completely unbelievable story, but some people believed it.
And he said that he'd persuaded Himmler to call off a plan to starve millions of people in occupied France, Belgium, and Holland.
Yes, these are all tall tales that came up after the war make sure that having been Himmler's masseur would not hamper his career.
Do you see any parallels with people in today's news now when demagogues abroad and at home are assaulting the truth once more?
I do, which is one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, because I think that in a political atmosphere where people don't only tell lies, I mean, people have always told lies, and politicians also, but where it doesn't matter anymore, where there is no such thing as truth. This happens under dictatorships. It happens under foreign occupation. It's happening even in our democracies today. And this is the perfect atmosphere for chancers and self-mythologizers and self-invented characters and scoundrels of all kinds to come to the fore. People who had normally been in the margins suddenly can sort of act out roles that can be very malign. And I think, in a way, we've already seen that in the 4 years of Donald Trump, when those kind of types tended to come up. I only need to mention the name Roger Stone.
Should I assume that Roger Stone will be the subject of a future book of yours?
No, not necessarily. And I'm not saying he was a murderer or is a murderer. I'm just saying he's the kind of chancer who, in normal circumstances, would never have been in the news. But my collaborators are a little bit like that. I mean, they suddenly can start, maybe not appear center stage, but appear on the stage of real power because of extraordinary circumstances in which truth no longer matters. Everything is propaganda.
Are you saying to some degree here that the stories that we hear throughout history tend to be simplified and that we should really understand that things can be a lot more complicated?
That is part of the purpose of writing a book like this. Yes, I was born in December 1951, so I had no experience of the war, but I grew up in the shadow of the war. And in a country that had been occupied, there was really in the 50s and until the mid-60s, everything was black and white. You'd been good or you'd been bad.
This is the Netherlands.
Yes. And this was true all over Europe. And we began to realize really in the 60s that it's not that morally easy. And some bad people did good things, some good people did bad things. Some people joined the resistance out of idealism, other because they wanted adventure. Some people collaborated because they needed to protect their families, and so on and so forth. It's a complicated issue. And I think literature, and I include this kind of history writing in literature, you have to look for the complications and not for easy moral condemnation, which is, in my view, not very interesting and doesn't make us think more deeply.
Well, Anne Frank's diaries are what most people for many years thought of as what was happening in the Netherlands at the time that the Nazi occupation is that just a distorted view?
No, I don't think so at all. I think Anne Frank, first of all, I think she was a very talented writer, and there's nothing distorted about the idea that Jews everywhere, where the Nazis were in power, were destined for mass murder, and she was one of them. So there's certainly no there's nothing distorted about her situation. What is perhaps more complex is that some people tried to protect her family. Clearly, somebody betrayed them. We're still not sure who it was or what the reasons for the betrayal were, and that's where it starts getting murky. But the story of persecution and genocide is certainly not a myth or a distorted story.
You argue that what connects the three subjects of your book is their outsized self-delusional fabulism. Is that fabulism or fabulism? Didn't all three describe themselves as saviors who had noble causes and sacred lives and saved lives?
Well, that's, of course, what self-mythologizers and chancers and liars and demagogues always claim. I mean, Donald Trump claims to make America great again. So that's not an unusual claim for people to make who are actually sometimes doing the opposite.
You're listening to Leonard.
By which I would say there are very few people who do bad things purely for the sake of malice I mean, Shakespeare has a few characters like that, Iago, Richard III, perhaps. But in real life, people rarely would admit to doing something purely for the sake of doing something, for the sake of evil. They usually have some rationalization that it's for a higher cause or whatever.
And it's for, and we're the ones who decide whether it was really just evil, total evil.
Yes, but I think total evil in that sense is rather rare.
Well when you go into a school and shoot up the school and kill a bunch of children.
Yes, I mean there's no way you can possibly defend it. But I think again, somebody like Hitler was an extremely rare case. Mm. You know, most of the people, including Himmler, probably had talked themselves into believing that they would do what they were doing was good.
You don't think Hitler thought that he was doing good things?
But I would hesitate.
He must have self-justified on some level, no?
He may have done. It was a sort of racial idea of racial grandeur and so on, but so mixed up with personal resentment and rage that I would hesitate to climb into his head, and I don't think we either have the time nor do I have the inclination to psychoanalyze him.
And of course the people who did terrible things to the slaves that they owned throughout a large part of the history of this country.
Yes, but again, I don't think you can. It's difficult to generalize about a history like that. First of all, the way slaves were treated in some plantations were probably worse than in others. The system was certainly something that one couldn't possibly condone. When you go into the personal behavior of individuals in history, things become a little bit more complex.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Ian Baruma. If you sign up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $50 or more, you can receive a free copy of his book, the book we are discussing, The Collaborator's Three Stories of Deception and Survival in World War II. To do that, just go online to give to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950 during today's show, and we'll be happy to send you a copy. That's give and the number 2WBAI.org or 212-209-2950. But don't forget to make that $50 donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, and we thank you very much. And return now to Ian Baruma. The book we're discussing is The Collaborator's Three Stories of Deception and Survival in World War II from Penguin Press. Mr. Baruma is a former editor of the New York Review of Books and the author or co-author of many books. He is you're now a professor at Bard College?
Yes, I am.
Do you miss being running a major prestigious publication like the New York Review of Books?
Well, I miss it in that I could have done interesting things with it, in my own view, but I don't miss it in the sense that I have a great deal more time now to do my own writing, which in the end is something I prefer to do.
Hmm. Are there other things you want to tell us about these three people or the situations that they were engaged in?
That's a hard question to answer because it.
Well, I've just done a cursory glance, and there are some incredible details here. So let's look a little deeper into the story of Kawashima Yoshiko.
Mm-hmm.
What else should we know about her?
Well, I'll tell you how I knew about her first. And this, again, is a story of deception in the period, which very much fits the book. The Japanese in Manchukuo, which in itself, this was Manchuria, which mm-hmm. the Japanese built up in the 1930s as a puppet state. It's now northeastern China. And everything about Manchukuo, or the state of Manchuria, was phony. The Japanese pretended it was independent. It wasn't. They said it was multiracial and based on racial equality. It wasn't, et cetera. But it was modern in many ways. The Japanese wanted it to be a showcase of Asian modernity. And one of the things they built was the most modern film studio in Asia. And they made propaganda movies, Japanese propaganda movies, usually with stories of a Chinese woman who fell in love with a brave Japanese soldier and that sort of thing. And they needed a Chinese actress who could play these roles, who spoke both Chinese and Japanese fluently. And they couldn't really find anybody until they found this Japanese, young Japanese girl, born in Manchuria in China, who was bilingual. And they gave her a Chinese stage name, and it was a state secret that she was really Japanese. So they pretended she was a Chinese actress playing in these propaganda films. And she became hugely popular in Japan, not so much in China. She knew Kawashima Yoshiko. Her name was Yamaguchi Yoshiko. And she became a big star. After the war, she went back to Japan, changed her name from Lee Koran or Lee Xianglan, which was a Chinese stage name, to Shirley Yamaguchi, and started playing Japanese geishas and so on, who fell in love with brave American soldiers in Hollywood pictures, and was in The King and I on Broadway. And so she nicely switched in a sort of way that reflects in some ways the history of modern Japan. And I knew her and interviewed her and actually wrote a novel about her. And she'd known the other Yoshiko intimately. And so that's really how my fascination for the other character grew.
Well, that's a fascinating story. She was also forgiven to some degree for what she had done during the war.
Absolutely. And she became a politician for the ruling party. And her role was to go around Asia, shaking hands with Asian dictators like Kim Il-sung in North Korea at the time, and to apologize for what the Japanese had done during the war, to repair relations between Japan and the rest of Asia. That was her role.
Now, we mentioned that Friedrich Weinrib was a Hasidic Jew in Holland. Mm-hmm. Would you have known he was a Hasidic Jew? Did he dress like a Hasid
and
all of that?
No, he didn't, although he had a beard. But I knew about him because he became a guru who taught usually wealthy, elderly, non-Jewish ladies the secrets of life. By reading the Bible in a Kabbalistic manner, and according to real scholars, a totally spurious manner. I knew about him because my best friend at university would take Bible classes during the weekends with his grandmother. And being a stupid student, for about 5 minutes, I took this seriously. And I was studying classical Chinese at the time, and I remember going to class and asking my professor whether it wouldn't be a fruitful way to read Han Dynasty texts, classical Chinese texts, through a sort of Kabbalistic lens. And I remember their eyes rolling. And I remember also going back to meet my friend, and both of us thought this was a sign of the deep superficiality of my professors. So that's how I knew about Weinrib. He exercised a certain... He attracted these kind of ladies, and he had to flee to Switzerland after the war because some of these ladies accused him again of abusing them. And so he had to get out of Holland fast. Yeah. Sexual abuse. So he got out of Holland fast, but his career took off again in Switzerland, where he died peacefully in his bed, as far as I know.
He said those medical exams were required for emigration.
But this was all, of course, phony. I mean, he was just exercising his own power fantasies.
Now, as we mentioned earlier, he took large amounts of money from Jews in an imaginary scheme to save them from deportation to concentration camps, although he betrayed some of them to German secret police. What about the others? Did he just take the money and then leave them?
Well, most of them in the end got caught and ended up in the death camps. Some of them claim that while they were on his list, it allowed them to go underground into hiding, and that's why they survived the war. So he had his supporters. But what was very strange about his case is that he claimed that his list was backed by a German general called von Schumann. And the general was as imaginary as the list. It was a fantasy. But when he was caught by the Gestapo, he tried to convince them that it had all been made up, and so he wasn't really guilty of anything. They wouldn't believe him because there was a great rivalry between the SS and the German army, and they wanted to believe that there had to be some German general, army general, who was in on this scam, and then asked Weinreb to help them track him down, which was the reason why Weinreb was released after his first arrest, which almost never happened. If you were a Jew and you were arrested by the Gestapo, you very rarely got out. He did. And so his story got more and more involved. And so he ended up trying to hoodwink the Gestapo as well as trying to hoodwink Jews to get onto his list. And in the end, of course, the game was up and people were onto him, and he had to go into hiding himself.
And Felix Kirsten, we said earlier, claimed that he convinced Heinrich Himmler to do positive things. Do we know whether any of that was true?
Well, at the end of the war, Kirsten, who was a deft operator, he realized that things were not going well for Germany, so he managed to relocate to Stockholm in neutral Sweden. And at the end of the war, Himmler tried to make a deal with the Allies, that the Allies would put Himmler at the head of Germany and fight the Russian, the Soviet Union together.
But he was a Finn, wasn't he? Why didn't he go back to Finland?
No, this is Himmler. Himmler.
No,
And Himmler was the head of the SS.
Yeah.
And Himmler thought some kind of deal with the Allies could be made at the end of the war, which would let him off. And in exchange for that, Himmler was prepared to release some Jews from concentration camps. So these weird negotiations were going on. Kirsten, who was then in Stockholm, played a role as a kind of middleman. One of the things he did was introduce the representative in Sweden of the World Jewish Congress to Himmler. And an extraordinary meeting took place while the war was still going on. In Kirsten's country house outside Berlin, where the head of the Jewish Congress in Stockholm flew in while Berlin was still being bombed, met Himmler, and Himmler wanted to shake hands and said, "Perhaps it's time for our peoples to bury the hatchet." And as a result of this, some Jews were released. Now, after the war, the Swedes claimed that they were responsible for this. Through their negotiator, it was Count Volker Bernadotte, later assassinated in Jerusalem by Itzhak Shamir's gang. Mm. And Kirsten claimed that he had been responsible. Again, here it gets so murky, we'll never know exactly what happened. But some kind of negotiations did go on.
In your epilogue, you say that their primary sins, your three subjects, was that they conned themselves, even though other people were victims?
No, of course the victims suffered more than anybody else. There's no question, but I don't think you need to stress that the Third Reich was a terrible thing, and persecution of Jews is to be totally condemned, and that the Japanese were up to no good in China. That seems to me fairly obvious. But when you think of what these three characters have done, apart from causing a great deal of harm to people, that goes without saying. But the theme of what holds them together in my story is the story of deception and self-deception. And what I said in the end was not a way to sort of get them off the hook for what they'd done. What I was trying to say is that all of us make up our lives as we go on. We all re-edit our memories. We all tell ourselves stories about who we are and what our lives are to some extent. But we don't all completely deceive ourselves by making everything up. And I think that is something that these three characters did. And this comes from an atmosphere and an attitude in which the truth no longer matters at all. And what I was trying to point out, that this is an extremely dangerous atmosphere to get ourselves in. And here, there is a clear allusion to our own time. Allusion, not illusion, but allusion to our own time.
The reviews that you've received for this book have been really wonderful, but a couple of people have said maybe you've been a little too kind or let your subjects off a little too easy. How would you respond to that?
Well, there's one reviewer who said that, and I would respond to that by repeating what I said earlier, that writing about characters, whether they're in a play or in a novel or historical, simply to condemn them and to bang home to the reader that how bad these people are is not very interesting. It doesn't allow you to understand human behavior any better. Again, if that had been the only point of, let's say, Shakespeare's Richard III, it wouldn't be an interesting play. You have to. I think the whole point of writing about people is to reach a greater understanding of what makes us tick. And I think simply expressing one's outrage is not the most effective way of doing that. I know that this is an unfashionable thing to say in a period in which expressing moral outrage has become the kind of thing to do, but I resist it.
So what happened to each of them? First, Kawashima Yoshiko after the war.
Well, Kawashima Yoshiko was executed by the Chinese nationalists, the people who later fled to Taiwan after being defeated by the communists in the 1940s. So she had the worst fate. Weinreb ended up in Switzerland, escaping from Dutch justice. And died there. The end of Kirsten is as unknowable as so much else in his life. There are claims that he died while traveling to France, where he was going to receive an award from François Mitterrand, the president at the time, for his brave resistance during the war, because in France, this is a myth that is still very much believed. And by the way, a film is being made at the moment with Woody Harrelson as Kirsten, taking as its primary material a French biography or hagiography of Kirsten, which completely takes his myth as face value. And so that's one thing, one explanation of his death. The other one is that he died somewhere in a hotel in Hamburg. It's unknown. That he died is the one thing we do know for sure.
Well, he would be very old right now if he hadn't died.
He would. Even he wouldn't have been capable of doing that.
In the few minutes that we have left, are there any things you want to add?
I think we've pretty much covered everything. I hope that the first half doesn't get too distorted by the bad connection.
Well, I think we have saved the show with this better connection here. But
very good.
But I guess I was asking you earlier whether you saw parallels with people in today's news. I think the real question would be, do you think that there are similar situations in almost every conflict? I mean, right now,
in Ukraine
right now, for example, and in Russia, I'd imagine that there are some very complicated things going on.
That's, of course, true, and certainly in terms of collaboration. And there was a very good article in The New Yorker some months ago describing the situation in Ukrainian towns when they're occupied by Russian troops. And Ukrainians, in order to keep people fed, cooperate with the Russians, because otherwise everything collapses. And then when the Ukrainians take these towns back, they're often arrested as traitors. Now, there it gets very morally very difficult. And of course, it's a very complicated situation there. But I think my larger point would be that the more you have real debate and people listen to each other, government is transparent, and so on, and the more people, there is some kind of consensus that truth matters, the less room there is for this kind of malign fantasizing. So in a society where there is strong censorship, where there is oppression, or where people can no longer agree that there are certain criteria for what is true and what isn't true, which is more or less the case now in the United States, I think, even though it is still a democracy. This is when fantasy can start running wild, boosted, of course, by social media and so on, which is a great threat to our democracy.
I've been speaking with Ian Baruma, who was born in the Netherlands, studied Chinese at Leiden University and cinema at Nihon University in Tokyo. He's lived and worked in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London, and New York, which is quite obvious considering some of the things that he told us during this conversation. He's a regular contributor to Harper's and The New Yorker, writes monthly columns for Project Syndicate and Bloomberg, and is a professor at Bard College. What do you teach at Bard?
I teach different things most years, but I like doing a film course, but showing films that allow us to discuss history and politics and so on, as well as cinema. And I also do a course on literary journalism, not to teach people how to write so much as reading texts beginning in the 18th century all the way up to Zadie Smith, which again allows the students to get some taste of history and culture and so on from different points of view, historical as well as personal or political, which I think is an extremely, extremely important thing to do at a time of great polarization and orthodoxy.
The book we've been discussing is The Collaborators, Three Stories of Deception and Survival in World War II, published by Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
And that brings us to the end of our show. If you're just discovering this program and would like to hear more about one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access our over 800 past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. Our podcast, which has surpassed 1 million plays, is available on iTunes, Apple, and everywhere else you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@wbai.org. Somebody asked me to spell my name out so that you could reach me, L-O-P-A-T-E, Leonard Lopate. Before I sign off today, I need to ask you to support WBAI to keep this station coming to you. We are going through a really rough time, so we're asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by calling 212-209-2950 or by going online to give to WBAI.org right now. We need your help to keep bringing you this unique in-depth content, information you usually don't get anywhere else. And as I mentioned earlier, anyone who makes a contribution of $50 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large right now can receive a copy of Ian Baruma's latest book, The Collaborators, Three Stories of Deception and Survival in World War II. So why not make that call right now at 212-209-2950 or go online to give to WBAI.org. And remember, WBAI Pacifica is an important alternative to mainstream censorship because we address important issues that are often overlooked and give voice to important to the voiceless and the marginalized among us. And that's why we are asking you to support us also. We are offering flash drives called the Best of BAI for a pledge of $99. When you call, you can say, I want the Best of BAI shows and favorite hosts, or Best of BAI classic past historical truths, or Best of BAI current events and consequences. You might also consider becoming a sustaining member, what we call a BAI buddy, with a monthly contribution of $15, $20, $25, whatever you feel comfortable with. And we'll say thank you with a BAI tote bag to anyone who signs up to become a BAI buddy for $10 a month or more. But either way, it's important to support this station. We are completely free speech radio. You're the only station in the New York Dial that's 100% listener-sponsored. And your support will be tax-deductible. And we hope you can join us again tomorrow when my guest will be Christina Gerhardt discussing her new book, Sea Change, An Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean. We'll see you then.
Listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm a student at NYU and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going. And the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI buddy system. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
Do you think this war will ever end?
I don't know. They'll just have another one.
I want to get out of here. Don't you?
Not that much.
So you like it here?
It's not that bad.
You're in a foxhole with a war raging outside.
I know. That's why I'm sure glad I've got my WBAI.
Be glad you've got your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org. Now, do it now.